Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. While the Pacific Northwest and the rest of the world is wracked by the COVID-19 pandemic, another kind of pandemic threatens our region. An increasing number of oil trains, each loaded with 3 million gallons of crude oil, traveling down the Columbia River and through Portland. Even though the Tesoro Savage oil-by-rail terminal in Vancouver, Washington, which would have been North America's largest oil-by-rail terminal, was stopped 2.5 years ago, other oil transloading facilities are rearing their ugly heads in Portland and at Global Partners' facility at Port Westward near Clatskanie, Oregon. Today we talk with Patsy Kohlberg with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, about why Global Partners' lack of transparency and long track record of environmental violations in Oregon and elsewhere around the country makes them an unreliable partner for Oregon communities. Patsy and Dan, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara. Nice to be here.
Great to be on.
And Patsy, I just want to mention, has been my Locus Focus engineer for quite a while. We haven't been seeing each other in person except running into each other at the park for the last 4 months, so it's nice to have you in my studio. We're going to talk today about a threat that I think a lot of people thought might have gone away, which is the threat of oil trains that are coming through in massive amounts through Oregon. A couple years ago, the communities around Southwest Washington and Northwest Oregon stopped what would have been the world's largest oil train terminal in Vancouver. And I think a lot of people thought that the problem of oil trains was going to go away. But it seems that in the last year or so, year and a half, there's been a resurgence with a ferocity. So, Dan, what is the source of all this oil train traffic that we're seeing now in Oregon?
So we're seeing oil coming now from both the Bakken crude oil formation in North Dakota and the Canadian tar sands production area in Alberta, Canada. In fact, just a couple weeks ago, I was down looking at the rail car unloading at the Zenith facility in Portland, and I saw both types of oil. There was one type in the rail yard, in the Wilbridge rail yard, and there was another type actually being actively unloaded there at Zenith. And, you know, what we're seeing there is probably building up the storage tanks because there's sort of a glut of oil on the market. So oil companies, producers are looking for places to ship and to store this oil until prices go back up. And there's been sort of a downturn actually in recent weeks in activity at Zenith. And so the other facility that we're going to talk about today, Global Partners, you know, they had sought back in 2018 permission to ship heavy oil from the port of Columbia County. And this really raised alarm bells for people all over the region about the potential for a lot more heavy oil coming through the region. So we'd seen, you know, what can happen when an oil train carrying Bakken crude oil derails in Mosier. And that was, about 4 years ago. And we saw this spectacular fire, a really scary incident very close to the school there in Mosier. And kind of at the other end of the oil spectrum is this very heavy oil coming out of Alberta. And sometimes it's diluted with chemicals that make it more volatile. And that's called diluted bitumen. And this is what was potentially going to be coming our way, headed for Global Partners. And some of that diluted bitumen is already coming into Zenith. So what the oil industry is really trying to do is to find as many flexible pathways to get their product to market as they can. And particularly when oil prices go back up, I think we'll see the pressure for more and more oil trains to increase yet again.
A few years ago, there was an issue with oil trains going through Rainier, Washington on their way to Clatskanie, I guess to Port Westward. So this oil train issue in Oregon is not a new thing. Let's talk a bit about Global Partners' beginnings at Port Westward and how that has transformed over the last few years.
How oil trains came to move through Columbia County is really important because it's instructive for the situation we're facing now with Global Partners. The facility there at Port Westward called the Columbia Pacific Biorefinery was built to make ethanol out of corn. And there was a significant amount of public money that went into subsidizing that facility. And so people in Columbia County thought they were going to be seeing corn trains coming through. That facility went bankrupt and out of bankruptcy was bought by the company, ultimately sold to Global Partners. There was another company that owned it in between. And so when Global Partners bought it, they kind of quickly and quietly transitioned the facility to shipping crude oil. And in fact, they started moving crude oil in volumes that exceeded their DEQ permit, and they were fined for that in 2013. So all of a sudden in, 2013, people started seeing these long black trains filled with crude oil. And you could tell they're crude oil because they're marked 1267 on the side of the placard, rolling through towns like Scappoose and St. Helens and Columbia City and Rainier. And in Rainier, it's pretty dramatic because, the main street in Rainier is actually the rail line itself. And so this raised real alarms with people because right around the same time, we started seeing oil trains beginning to derail all over North America. And in July of 2013, about 7 years ago exactly, we saw this really spectacular oil train derailment in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, which cost 47 people their lives. It was a terrible tragedy where the brakes weren't properly set and a train rolled downhill into the middle of a small community there called Lac-Mégantic. And, that was a huge wake-up call. And people realized at that moment just how unbelievably dangerous oil trains could be. And what we saw was a sort of seamless shift from one type of commodity, ethanol at the time, or really it was supposed to be corn trains, to oil trains. And so now what we're facing is, DEQ has just reissued an air pollution permit for Global Partners. And Global Partners is touting this as a potential shift towards renewable diesel. And, one of the big concerns we've had is that the permit clearly allows for up to 2 oil trains a day to come through Columbia County. And that means that those oil trains would be coming through Portland neighborhoods and Vancouver neighborhoods and Columbia River Gorge communities like, Bingen and White Salmon and Stevenson, Washougal and Camas, places that see these oil trains moving at much higher speeds than they would move even in Columbia County. And so they pose a pretty dramatic risk there. This rush to approve the permit by DEQ for Global Partners was really a slap in the face, I think, to the more than 2,000 people who weighed in and asked the agency to slow down, to consider not just the issue of oil trains, but to consider the pollution impacts of handling this very potentially large volume of oil. And DEQ didn't do that. And it's disappointing, and it's clear that, 4 years after the Mosier oil train derailment, DEQ still hasn't gotten the message that Oregonians and Washingtonians and people all over the region are absolutely opposed to the idea of more oil trains coming through this region. And so we're left really with no safeguard and having to rely on Global Partners' word, essentially, that they're going to be moving renewable diesel instead of crude oil when there's nothing to stop them from shifting back to Bakken crude oil or to tar sands crude at any time.
Well, Patsy, your group, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, was one of the 2,000 organizations and individuals who commented. What were the concerns that you raised in your comments that you filed with the DEQ?
We had a number of concerns. We found it very problematic that facility has been issued 2 separate permits that govern 4 separate activities. And this makes it extremely difficult for the groups who are trying to monitor these activities to figure out what contribution to the toxic pollution each activity contributes. And particularly when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions, it really obfuscates what's going on at that facility. And it's not fair to those of us in the community who are trying to decide whether this is something that we want in Oregon. And then beyond that, I think we were very concerned about the narrow approach, and I think Dan kind of alluded to this, the very narrow approach to permitting that DEQ takes that really confines itself to the footprint of that actual facility. And any emissions that occur upstream, downstream, any of the mobile emissions, none of those are taken into consideration. And it's even worse when you get to greenhouse gases, because if they're going to be moving the tar sands oil, the net effect on global greenhouse gases from tar sands oil is huge. And what you really need to do is an entire life cycle analysis. A life cycle analysis is an analysis of the global greenhouse gas emissions from the moment you start extracting the oil to transporting it, storing it, refining it, shipping it out, the entire site and how it gets used at the other end. So then you have an accurate picture on whether this is good for global warming or not good for global warming. And that's really what we need to attend to.
I kind of remember a hearing the DEQ held a number of years ago around a coal transport facility that was proposed for around Boardman. And a lot of people were testifying, and they were talking about greenhouse gas emissions, and they were talking about a lot of concerns about why coal is bad, besides the fact that there's all this coal dust that was going to be deposited everywhere. It was very frustrating to everybody who was testifying against this facility back then, because all DEQ was considering was the amount of pollution that was going directly into the river, mainly the coal dust. And all the greenhouse gas concerns, they said that was irrelevant. I wonder if this is an indication of how DEQ is still dealing today with dealing with the pollution coming from these oil terminals.
Yeah, I think they have a very narrow approach, which considers just the footprint of that particular facility. And when it comes to net effects on global greenhouse gases, that's completely inadequate. And what you really need is a life cycle analysis that looks at the greenhouse gas emissions that start from when you first extract the oil or the gas or whatever from the ground, the storage of it, the transportation of it, the refinement of it, and then how it's transported and used at the other end. And then you know whether this is good for global warming or not. Without that kind of analysis, you really don't know.
One of the challenges about all of this is that players like Global Partners and Zenith seem to be coming in and taking advantage of our region, which was a region that did not historically serve as a fossil fuel hub. Dan, what are some of the reasons do you think that companies like Zenith and Global Partners are able to move into Oregon and take advantage of us?
I think that one of the main issues that we face is the lack of a comprehensive statewide environmental policy act, the ability to look at the comprehensive impacts of projects like these. And so to the north and to the south, California and Washington, if you were to propose something like this in those states, you would have to do a state-level environmental impact assessment of some kind. And this is what we saw in Vancouver when the Tesoro Savage oil train terminal was proposed, and people in that community were able to use that process to put on full display the total range of issues there. So they called in experts who pointed out that, you know, there were huge public safety risks to the community of Vancouver and uprail communities from having up to 5 loaded trains a day coming in. You know, in this case, Global Partners could have roughly 2 loaded trains coming through per day, still a very significant risk. And so that absence of having a State Environmental Policy Act or a SEPA makes Oregon much more vulnerable, because we end up with these very siloed reviews. And so in this case, for instance, with this air contaminant discharge permit that DEQ just issued, they took a very, very narrow view. They went so far as to not even consider the potential emissions of the actual rail unloading. We said, you shouldn't take the company on its word that there are no emissions from opening up these rail cars and physically unloading 120,000 barrels of oil a day into tanks at Port Westward. There are probably some emissions that escape from that process, right? People, at least anecdotally, had talked about the overpowering smell down at Zenith. Now, if you're standing on Front Avenue in Zenith when they're unloading oil, it's very pungent. There are emissions that are associated with this rail unloading activity. And we know that some of this oil has toxic air pollutants like hydrogen sulfide and volatile organic compounds like benzene, sometimes at very high levels. And so DEQ's unwillingness to use even its narrow review authority was surprising in this case. And in other ways, we asked DEQ to consider, you know, the range of the types of oil that might come into this facility. And they said, no, we're only going to consider potentially Bakken crude oil, which is a certain type of oil that tends to be lighter and more volatile. DEQ already has material safety data sheets that show the type of pollutants that are included in diluted bitumen, the tar sands crude that's coming into Portland. They could have used that information to help inform their analysis on global, but they didn't choose to do that. They said, no, if they switch to tar sands later, we'll ask them to do a notice of construction and to let us know. You know, that's not a public process. That's not something that people will have a substantive way to really weigh in on. You know, one of the things that just really jumps out as glaring is, you know, we pointed out to DEQ that, you know, PGE had been considering selling a big set of oil storage tanks to global partners. And a bunch of community groups had weighed in with PGE and said, you know, we really think this is in conflict with utilities' public safety and climate goals. And we think this is not consistent with, you know, PGE's kind of mission and vision as it lays out on its own website and communications. That sale has actually been canceled, you know, in part at least due to that public pressure. And so PGE in May informed the Public Utility Commission of Oregon that it was no longer planning to sell those tanks to global partners. And yet, DEQ included those tanks in the permit. I mean, it makes no sense to include tanks in a permit when the company has no authority over them, no right to use them, doesn't own them, has no agreement to use them. It's bizarre, it's sloppy, and it shows that DEQ was in a rush here to give Global, you know, whatever it wanted in this permit. That's very disappointing, and it really runs counter to what we see in our region, which is a growing recognition that these dangerous, hazardous rail shipments coming through our communities, you know, are at loggerheads with public safety, and they put neighborhoods and communities at risk.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dr. Patsy Kullberg with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, about Global Partners' plans to drastically increase oil trains through Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington. Well, Patsy, I want to talk about some of your concerns about the health issues related to this. After all, you are part of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. So why is PSR so up in arms about oil trains in general, and specifically about what's going on at Global Partners?
Well, we are up in arms about it, and I'm going to set aside for a moment the safety concerns, because that's a huge concern for both the Bakken crude and for the tar sands oil. Little different scenario for each kind of oil. And talk a little bit more about just the diesel pollution that is related to having up to 200 car unit trains coming through these neighborhoods in Portland and these small communities. If you look at where the trains come through potentially in Portland, the rail routes, and you look at a map of that, you find that the areas that they're coming through are the exact same areas where the 10 top polluters in the city are located. And they're also areas where you have high concentrations of communities of color, immigrant communities, and low-income communities. So these are communities that are already subject to elevated levels of air pollution. And we all know that air pollution is a growing problem in Portland. And we're particularly concerned about what we call the particulate matter, which is these little tiny particles that are emitted as a result of incomplete combustion of any kind of fossil fuel. And these come along with the diesel emissions from the trains coming through. So they are adding to this very toxic environment. And then you overlay onto that the COVID pandemic, because we know that communities of color and low-income communities are more susceptible to getting infected, and they have worse outcomes when they are infected. But we also know from research that communities that live in more highly polluted areas, and particularly areas that are polluted with this particulate matter, have a harder time with COVID, and they have poorer outcomes. So it's like this triple whammy, and having these trains come through is just going to make that situation worse for those communities.
That brings it back to another issue, which kind of reminds me of the FERC decision about Jordan Cove in the middle of a pandemic. Why is DEQ approving this permit for Global Partners in the middle of a pandemic, and when it's actually much harder for people to make public comments? Because obviously you're doing all of this online. We can't, there's no hearings, there's no places where people can go physically and gather and express their outrage. What is your sense of why all this is happening during a pandemic?
Well, from my perspective, I think we have a problem with regulatory capture. The DEQ is beholden to the corporate interests, and they kind of roll over for the whatever it is that the corporations want. I mean, otherwise, you have to assume that they're either extremely careless or incompetent, or that they really just don't care about public input. My feeling is that they are in collusion, actively in collusion, and they don't care about the public input so much.
It's hard to draw a conclusion other than, you know, DEQ just really doesn't get it on oil trains, that they view their role too narrowly when it comes to addressing the public's concerns on these issues. You know, we've seen DEQ in other contexts do the right thing. You know, they denied the Clean Water Act certification for the Jordan Cove LNG terminal and Pacific Connector pipeline. That was a decision that was pretty obvious, though. You know, I mean, that's the most destructive project probably that Oregon's ever seen. Now, someone might argue that the idea of running bomb trains through Portland, Vancouver, and a bunch of Columbia County towns is also fairly obvious. You know, what we thought was that there were some compelling technical reasons why the permit as drafted had flaws, it had gaps, and DEQ chose not to address those issues. You know, their motivations for pushing this out quickly seem to be driven more by Global's timeline. And Global is really touting this idea that they're in a rush to begin shipping renewable diesel. And they told the Longview Daily News just yesterday that they plan to start shipping renewable diesel as soon as this fall. And what's alarming about the situation is that we are left to trust Global Partners that they will not go back to shipping crude oil anytime soon. And that's a situation that we've been in before. You know, we've seen this company switch essentially overnight from ethanol to crude oil back in 2012 and 2013 when that occurred. You know, the community didn't get warning and the oil trains started running, and they started running in volumes that exceeded DEQ's permit. So for DEQ to leave the public and these communities in a position of having no bulwark, no safeguard against potentially two oil trains per day running through these towns, it's a huge mistake in our view, when there were really, we think, pretty strong reasons for them to narrow this permit to make it stronger. If Global Partners is so serious about removing renewable diesel, there was no reason for them to have crude oil in this permit at all. But they went out of their way to make sure that crude oil was part of this permit, that crude oil was specifically allowed. 1.8 billion gallons of liquid fuel of some type each year, and that adds up to 120,000 barrels a day. And that's just a huge potential risk for communities along these rail lines. Dr. Colbert has spoken to this, but it ends up being that these risks fall often most heavily on the communities that are very close to where these trains go through. And so while DEQ is choosing to look exceedingly narrowly at its authority at just the terminal and not even looking at all the impacts of the terminal, and then divvying up the terminal into different pieces under different permits so as to avoid having to look at this project under a more stringent, higher level Title V permit, what we have is really something that's going to place a risk and a burden on Multnomah County communities, on communities in Clark County, and going all the way up the rail line. We do not favor being in the position of having to trust the goodwill of Global Partners not to run oil trains again when they've demonstrated so often in the past their willingness to push these trains through our communities.
Well, let's talk a bit about who Global Partners is. I mean, they're not a local company, are they?
No, as I understand, they are investors from obviously out of state, and they're Massachusetts-based. They've operated, you know, a facility in Albany, New York, where there's been a track record of violations and fines. There's a great report that looks into Global Partners' background and also the background of Zenith Energy. It was put together by the Center for Sustainable Economy, and it's called Crude Bailout. And if you Google that, you can find quite a bit of information about who's behind Global Partners and Zenith. The common thing between these two, Global and Zenith, is that they bought up facilities that were meant for something else. So in Global's case, they bought up a facility that was intended to make ethanol out of corn, and they turned it into something that for a while was shipping oil, is current and most recently has been transloading ethanol, not making it, but transloading it. And now they're talking about renewable diesel. But again, they went out of their way to make this permit inclusive of crude oil. And as recently as 2018, they asked the Port of Columbia County specifically for permission to ship heavy oil, the type of diluted bitumen that we see Zenith moving. They're not going to have to answer to anybody in Oregon unless it's in this permit, unless it's forced on them. And you know, the Port of Columbia County has made it pretty clear that they will, at least three of the remaining commissioners of the five, we're very willing to allow Global to move that heavy oil through. We're going to have to remain very vigilant and see what Global's next move is here. If they do stick with the renewable diesel business, that obviously raises fewer concerns than crude oil trains, but we're sort of operating without a safety net here because of DEQ's decision.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dr. Patsy Kohlberg with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, about Global Partners' plans to drastically increase oil trains through Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington. I want to talk a little bit about what this renewable diesel is. What is it and how benign is it really?
It really depends on what it's made from. There's a lot of people who are excited about its potential to replace fossil-based diesel. It's going to depend, at least in its carbon impacts, on what it's made from. There's some concern that one of the feedstocks could be palm oil. In other places, there have been commitments by some of the companies pursuing renewable diesel to use waste streams of spent oil. That certainly would be better than anything like, you know, virgin palm oil or even recycled palm oil.
You're talking about spent oil, you're talking about spent vegetable oil, not spent fossil oil.
Yeah, that's right. It's relatively new, and so it's really going to depend on the specific type of renewable diesel you're dealing with, and that's true of a lot of biofuels. So we don't know that much about the renewable diesel that Global Partners is touting and plans to handle. We're pretty curious to learn more about that. There is, at the same area where Global Partners would be potentially transloading renewable diesel, there's a proposal to make renewable diesel by a company called Next Energy. And we've been sort of watching that fairly closely because of the track record of that company. We have some pretty serious concerns. They had built a biofuels facility in eastern Washington that did not go well. And when they left it sort of untended after it went bankrupt, there was a big sort of toxic mess left behind, essentially a seed crusher in Odessa, Washington. So just important to know the details of these facilities before we get into them. I think it's safe to say we would consider renewable diesel differently and definitely on more of a case-by-case basis than something like tar sands crude or Bakken crude, which we know are dangerous, toxic, pose both direct public safety risks, but also huge risks in terms of a spill. You know, the volumes that they're talking about shipping when it comes to crude oil at 120,000 barrels a day, those two loaded oil trains a day, that's a really significant potential risk for our communities that we don't think that should have been part of this permit at all.
Well, last week on the show, I talked with Heather Price, who's an atmospheric chemist from Seattle, and we talked a little bit about renewable diesel, and we're talking about renewable natural gas, and then we got into renewable diesel as well. And she raised some concerns that renewable diesel might be better in terms of greenhouse gases, but actually is worse than fossil diesel in terms of some of the toxins that it emits from the tailpipe. Patsy, do you know anything about that?
I have read a study about some emissions that were, the study was conducted, I think, in a marine environment, and whether there were toxins that were being emitted that were affecting the people working on the ships. But I don't think there's a lot of research out there about that. I think in general, the tailpipe emissions of 100% renewable diesel are far better than the regular diesel. But the one other thing, a point I don't want us to lose sight of is how important it is to assess what the feedstock is, because palm oil, I believe that if you use palm oil as the feedstock, then you're looking at a net increase in global greenhouse gas emissions. But not only that, the palm oil plantations have been a huge source of deforestation in the world, and a huge source of human rights violations and human displacements. They've been very bad actors, the folks who have been developing these massive palm oil plantations in various places in the global south. And I think that's not an activity that we want to support.
I actually recall a few years ago when there were really bad fires in Indonesia, and most of those were started by palm oil plantations where they would burn the jungle, and actually they were burning the peat that was below the jungle. I guess another thing that Heather brought up was that you don't know often whether you're dealing with 100% renewable diesel or whether it's a mixture. And she doesn't think that right now there's any standards. She sort of described it to the early days of organics before there was USDA organic certification. So there's no certification. So you don't know what you're getting when you get renewable diesel. So the question might be, does global partners know what they're actually going to be shipping or making, for that matter?
These are important questions that, you know, remain sort of hanging out there now as they have this transloading permit, which allows them to handle crude oil, ethanol, or renewable diesel, or all three. Currently, they don't have a lot of tank storage capacity there, so it's not quite clear how they plan to move between these different commodities. If there's a silver lining to any of this, one of those is public comment was very clear and overwhelming that we don't want to see oil trains coming through. If Global's messaging is any indication, they seem to recognize that. They're talking an awful lot about renewable diesel, obviously for a reason. And Zenith has done the same thing in Portland, where they've tried to talk about their intention to move towards biofuels, obviously realizing that the communities all along the rail lines, that people don't want to see bomb trains rolling through. And that's, you know, a tacit acknowledgement that this effort to stand up to oil trains has had an impact, where even the oil companies are not really willing to admit what they really like to do. So again, we're just going to be evaluating sort of our options going forward with this DEQ permit, but also keeping a close eye to see what Global really does here going forward. The other place where I know people in Columbia County, there's a group called Envision Columbia County that has, you know, for years really kept a close eye on the Port of Columbia County. And I just want to appreciate their work in continuing to let the community know, you know, in Scappoose and St. Helens and Rainier and Columbia City about oil trains and how important it is for those communities, because the rail lines really divide each one of those towns, where in some cases you have your emergency response on one side of the tracks and your schools and your elder care facilities on another. You know, there's a group called Mothers for a Safe Columbia County. When we submitted our comments, you know, they made a very strong statement saying that they were very concerned about that dynamic and the proximity of the schools to the rail tracks. So we have to hope, I guess, at this point, because DEQ hasn't put anything in writing that's going to be helpful to us. We have to hope that Global has gotten the message here that oil trains are unacceptable. But there's nothing in the DEQ permit that is going to hold them to account to that, which is very unfortunate and really contradicts the public interest in our view.
Well, I just want to point out that Point Westward is a place that's really been trying to bring in all kinds of fossil fuel industries that the community doesn't want. And one of the largest ones, probably the largest one, was the proposed methanol refinery that was defeated. I just want to talk a bit about that and what kind of movement that engendered and what the outcome of that defeat has been in terms of people in Columbia County organizing against other planned projects at Port Westward.
Yeah, that's an interesting situation where they sort of ran that whole proposal in reverse. It looked like it had momentum at the beginning and back in 2014, and they made very little progress in the last, you know, many years. So the Port of Columbia County hasn't entirely given up on the idea of there being a methanol refinery there. And in fact, they are looking at rezoning a large acreage, over 800 acres of high-value farmland at Port Westward. And one of the potential uses of that high-value farmland would be a methanol refinery. One of the constraints they have there is at Port Westward is very unstable soil. A lot of the soil, you've already mentioned peat, is peat soil. The whole area has been subsiding over time. It's also within a diked area where the dikes are not certified. And so at some risk of flooding in a major event or in an earthquake. So there are some real challenges with putting, you know, a large fossil fuel infrastructure project at Port Westward. And I think what it shows in terms of the methanol project is that, you know, the communities on the Lower Columbia River are making connections between these different fossil fuels. You know, certainly in Columbia and Cowlitz counties, they've seen them all. You know, they've seen LNG, they've seen different versions of pipelines going different ways. They've seen oil and coal, LPG, you know, propane terminals, and hydrous ammonia facilities. It's been kind of a shotgun blast at the Lower Columbia River, and the communities, you know, what we're seeing also is that these industries are fickle, and when they don't make progress, you know, it doesn't create the type of economic development that people are hoping for. So it's, you know, Port Westward is a huge example of that, where for years and years and years, the Port of Columbia County has been promising this sort of pie in the sky, major mega developments. And the one thing, you know, that they built out there was an ethanol plant to make ethanol out of corn. And pretty quickly it went bankrupt and defaulted into an oil train terminal, which no one wanted. That's a really cautionary tale for what can happen. And it's one of the reasons why we're going to be looking very closely at the port's application to rezone that high-value farmland and supporting the people in Columbia County who are pushing back on that idea. And I know there are folks at, you know, 1,000 Friends of Oregon who have looked at this in the past and are going to be looking at it again in the future, who are very concerned about this, and farmers in the area who are concerned. And, you know, there's a really high value salmon habitat immediately adjacent to that area as well. So it's not just a soil and land issue. There's a big potential impact on the river right there. So, you know, we're watching closely to see what happens next at Port Westward. Unfortunately, Global Partners is only one piece of that puzzle, as we're learning.
Well, I was under the impression with the methanol refinery that they tried several times to get a land use change for that parcel of land, and every time it was denied by the Land Use Board of Appeals. So what's happened? I mean, why is it still alive?
That's correct. They're trying again is the short answer. They are going back for yet another round. And part of the issue there is they have to demonstrate that whatever they decide to do, if they were to convert that farmland to heavy industrial land, they have to demonstrate that that's compatible with the adjacent uses, whether that's high-value salmon habitat or farmland. And so that's not going to be super easy to demonstrate for something like, you know, a massive methanol refinery. And so we're just at the very beginning of that process, and we understand the port has submitted its application to the county. But yeah, it's pretty frustrating to be, you know, going through this loop where they keep trying to grab this big chunk of farmland over and over for what we are, you know, pretty sure is going to be some type of massive industrial project for fossil fuel use.
Well, Patsy, it seems that what's going on with Port Westward and this push to have more oil trains go through flies in the face of a lot of executive orders and other directions that are coming out of Salem. So I wanted to talk about this contradiction. Let's talk a little bit about Kate Brown's executive order, a few months ago, that basically sets a whole new set of goals for greenhouse gas emissions decrease. And how can the DEQ be approving something like more oil trains through the Columbia Gorge and through Columbia County when the state is taking such a different stand, supposedly?
Yeah, you're talking about executive order, 2004, and lays out, I think, an 85% reduction in the greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. I was just looking today, actually, on a report on how well we're doing that with that project. And we're not doing very well in the state of Oregon. And we're not going to meet those goals. And one of the reasons I think we're not going to, or we're on track not to meet them, is because of this very narrow approach that DEQ takes, even though it seems to have the regulatory authority to take a broader approach in terms of looking at life cycle analyses for greenhouse gas emissions for something like 2 crude oil trains a year, or a day, rather. So it is a contradiction, and I don't know why there isn't, why DEQ isn't holding corporations' feet to the fire. I don't know why Governor Brown isn't holding DEQ's feet to the fire on this issue.
Yeah, this is, to add to what Dr. Kohlberg is saying, this is really frustrating, where, you know, we pointed out in our coalition comments that, you know, the executive order specifically directs agencies, including DEQ, to, quote, exercise any and all authority and discretion vested in them to facilitate Oregon's achievement of the greenhouse gas goals. And so here we're talking about potentially the shipment of 120,000 barrels a day of crude oil, which could be even tar sands crude oil. You know, we did the math on that, where it's a stunning amount of potential greenhouse gas pollution. Amelia Ponte, who's a leader with the Mothers for Safe Columbia County down in near St. Helens, looked at this, and because it's about a third of the volume that the Tesoro Savage project would be, you know, she roughly estimated it would be about a third of the greenhouse gas impacts, and that's about 18 million tons per year of potential carbon pollution flowing through this facility. So it kind of boggles the mind that DEQ's response to this is that there is, quote, nothing specific in the executive order to suggest DEQ limit or adjust at this time the process for permitting or renewing permits. So they essentially just sidestep the issue, and they say, you know, we don't say anything specifically directing us not to issue permits like this or to even consider these issues. So there's a disconnect clearly between the agency and what we read in the governor's executive order. And so that's something that we're going to have to, I think, take up with both the agency and the governor's office to try to bring some more focus and seriousness to the agency so that they take the issue of oil trains more seriously going forward. I mean, you know, it's really not acceptable that we're going to be left in the position of having to trust global partners not to switch at some point in the future back to oil trains.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper, and Dr. Patsy Kohlberg with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility about global partners' plans to drastically increase oil trains through Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington. Well, I'm just wondering what we can do. I feel like we're sort of caught in this whirlpool, where we have the state agency, DEQ, which is supposed to be guaranteeing a healthy environment for the state of Oregon, for the people, for the habitat, for the wildlife, for everybody who lives here. And yet they are, I think, as both of your comments to the DEQ were stating, that DEQ's mission is not to enable corporate greed, basically. But how do you get DEQ to actually live up to its mission? I mean, where's the levers of power where we can actually start putting pressure on them to do the right thing? To do it's not just the right thing, but the absolutely necessary thing.
You know, one of the places that we'll be certainly making the case again will be the Environmental Quality Commission, which is the 5-member volunteer commission that oversees the agency. And, you know, people, a lot of people, you know, dozens of people over the past several years have spoken to this commission and urged them to engage with their staff and to support them in taking a harder look at these issues. And so maybe there's something more tangible that needs to happen there at the Environmental Quality Commission level to make it clear to DEQ that they need to dig more deeply into this. There will be another process like this coming up for the Zenith oil train terminal, except it will be more robust because Zenith needs what's called a Title V permit, which is a higher level of review and tends to be more stringent. So there will be, you know, another opportunity for people to go through this yet again, another bite at the apple for DEQ to maybe show that it does take oil train issues seriously, you know, with a facility that is actually currently moving oil, whereas Global is not currently moving oil. This is a really challenging time to be talking about oil trains. Like, people have other priorities. They need to be talking about, you know, the movement for Black Lives. You know, there are bigger things happening right now. And so we, at some level, we have to be able to trust our agencies to deal with, you know, problems like oil trains and to take a serious look at these permits when they come forward. And it's really frustrating that they haven't, because, you know, the community activists that we know have bigger fish to fry. You know, there are marches in the streets. There's a pandemic going on. There are a lot of other priorities that people need to work on right now that, you know, frankly, should be a higher priority than having to even think about a stupid permit for more oil trains coming through, you know, 4 years after we all saw how dangerous oil trains are, you know, with the Mosier derailment. So if my frustration is coming across, it's because it's there and it's real. And I think it reflects, you know, the more than 2,000 people who weighed in, who probably feel today quite dismissed by their agency. You know, I think there's more pressure that we need to apply.
I keep thinking back to DEQ letting Zenith get off the hook when it turned out that they hadn't done any trainings for transporting tar sands oil. And they just got away with it. I mean, DEQ just let them get away with it. I don't think anything's ever happened. And DEQ hasn't also had to pay the consequences for allowing this incredible lapse to happen. So it makes me not that hopeful about DEQ. On the same hand, I'm wondering, are there any other routes to put more pressure on DEQ, not just to do the right thing in terms of future permitting for Zenith, but to also do something to change this terrible decision they made yesterday to go ahead and grant the permit for Global Partners to actually transport oil through Oregon and Washington?
I'd like to weigh in on another issue related to that, which is, I think, the issues around corporate contributions to legislators' campaigns and the fact that Oregon permits it's a little bit of the Wild West here in Oregon compared to California or Washington. And I think that the net result of that is that we have a Department of Environmental Quality that is underfunded and does not have the political clout, does not have the backing to stand up to corporate interests, even if it wants to. I think it gets its marching orders from the legislature. And if the legislators are in the pockets of the fossil fuel industry, then I don't think we're going to get very far sort of hammering on the door of DEQ.
Well, there's one good legislator that's gotten elected, and that's Khan Pham. So I'm hoping maybe she'll be some influence on. I mean, that's one of the things that we can hope for. There is a turn. There seems to be a change in the wind, and there's excellent, really progressive people getting elected to state legislatures and to the federal government, to the Congress and the Senate. So do you have some hope that maybe we can, through the electoral process, get more people to get elected who will then put pressure on the DEQ to do what their mission is, which is to protect the environment?
Yeah, I would feel hopeful about that. I mean, I think we are in the midst of a sea change in this country around a lot of issues. And the polls that I've seen about supporting more stringent policies around addressing climate change, more people are coming on board with that. And I think that creates an atmosphere where we can address locally some of these issues, including fixing the corporate contribution issue.
What about you, Dan?
I'm sort of struggling with what comes next, and I think I'm not sure what we can do to bring as much focus to this issue and to bring the agency back into alignment with the community's values. The governor's executive order, in my mind, was fairly clear that it told these agencies to step up and to think differently. And here we saw the agency not do that. Yeah, I mean, I think what you said about some of these folks getting elected who have environmental justice in mind, that is going to help and maybe break that sort of polluted by money stranglehold that Rob Davis reported so well for the Oregonian. I think that, the standard, the bar can't be a 15-year campaign like we saw for Jordan Cove and the Pacific Connector. That struggle to stop that project, to get DEQ to deny that permit was incredible. And not every project is going to be quite as heinous an idea as the Pacific Connector gas pipeline. So we have to be able to get their attention on things that are more routinely reckless, like oil trains. And I think people are doing that. The work that people, just on a volunteer basis, the Zenith Collaborative in Portland that people did with, just creative actions in Portland to bring attention to this. I think there's so many more people who are aware of these issues than there used to be. And that's going to be really important, because what's frustrating about this to me is this is sort of like an own goal in soccer, where, we have plenty of bad ideas coming at us from the federal level when it comes to, increased pressure for oil trains and even LNG trains, ideas that seem so reckless that, they were sort of laughed off years ago as like, no one's crazy enough to try to run LNG trains. But here we are with that as a real approved idea now by the federal government. And so, we've had this idea that we would rely on our state agencies to protect Oregonians and people in our region and be more in alignment with the values that we have. And here we saw a real failing on that effort. So I think it's going to take more organizing and more creative action, and maybe actions that are, outside of this permitting system or that change the permitting system, which has clearly failed us in this case.
Well, I'm actually hopeful that all the protesting in the streets may actually start to rub off on the environmental movement as well and might bring it in, because there's so much intersectionality, and the people who are protesting are not just protesting against police brutality and against racism, and they're seeing all the social justice, all the environmental justice, all the racial justice issues that are all connected. And my guest last week, Heather, actually said this thing I love, which is that what's happened in the last month is that protest is again being recognized as a very necessary force in the United States. So how do you see we can protest our way back into having some sanity in our environmental regulatory process here in Oregon?
That's something that's going to have to evolve over the next months to year. The legislature in the last session before it was shortcut had some pretty interesting legislation in front of it. It was considering legislation that would have really curtailed oil and gas infrastructure on public lands controlled by the state of Oregon. That was legislation proposed by Representative Karen Power and Senator Jeff Golden. It also would have limited the volatility of oil. Those are ideas that actually, strengthen the state's hand. And I think that even bolder ideas, at some point the state of Oregon needs to think about putting some type of environmental review standard in place, something like a state environmental policy act that gives us more of a foothold to take a realistic look at the types of projects that come in and threaten our communities. Otherwise, we'll continue to be seen as this weak spot between Washington and California. Back in the early days of LNG, someone asked one of the executives from Bradwood LNG, why did you come to Oregon? And he said, because there's no SEPA. There's no environmental review in Oregon. And it turns out that people got really organized and found other creative ways to put pressure. And they actually got DEQ to deny a key permit for that project, 401 water quality permit under the Clean Water Act. So it's going to take more organizing. And as you said, you know, the intersectionality is important, because there are really critical issues facing our communities that demand attention. The violence that Black and brown people have been facing, the racist violence, you know, for years, that's a crisis that now is, you know, people are trying to address through protest and through action and through legislation. That is going to have to demand most of the attention from the activist community. And so we're going to have to find good targeted ways to make these agencies who are responsible for protecting the public from these environmental risks pay attention.
Well, thanks very much, Dan and Patsy, for joining us today. It's great talking to you. I hope to see you in person again in the near future, and hope to have you be my engineer again one of these days, Patsy. So thanks a whole lot.
That would be great.
Thank you for having us.
Today, we've been talking with Dr. Patsy Kohlberg with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and Dan Sears, Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us through these difficult times if you're able, by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership. You can donate on our website, kboo.fm, by clicking on the Donate button in the upper right-hand corner of our webpage. Next week, we'll talk with Timothy Inglesby, Executive Director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, about wildfire season during the pandemic. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and wash your hands.
Another time has come. Another world is here to meet the sun. Did you hear a circle there, a life to share? Another time is here. Another dawn whispers in my ear. A different sound. Point of view, a shade of blue.